The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
For those of you who were not here with us for this weekend, we've been celebrating our 40th anniversary. And holding our every 5 years Board of Governors meeting in which we imagine our future, our next 5 years, and invite the Sangha to bring their voice and their aspirations together so that we can gather all of those dreams and look at our path over the next 5 years. I was thinking about, because I was looking through some of the old mountain records, and I was looking at the 10th year edition of the mountain record, which was talking about our 10th year anniversary. And I remember that as a particularly significant one. I wasn't here for the 5th. And so the 10th was my first, and it, for me, it was particularly significant because it was an affirmation that we're still here. And as the bookkeeper at that time, that was something I was not always sure about. in fact, coming in and wanting to be ordained, wanting to be a monk and make my life here, that was a real part of my consideration, was whether this was going to work, whether it was going to be successful and just, you know. And, you know, I was just coming in, so I didn't really know the ins and outs of what was really going on. But it was plain that, you know, the demand was greater than the supply. And so I wondered about how that was all going to work out. So far, so good, as Dada Roshi often said. And so in looking at our coming years, you know, because as practitioners, and particularly having this place, this Buddha field, you know, we are here for our own practice, to develop ourselves, to liberate our lives, and to do all that we can in our lives to be a benefit in this world. But also our vision needs to be larger than that, that we're really here also for those who haven't come yet and those who we will never meet, hopefully into many future generations. And so in reflecting on that, you know, what is, you know, we are here, but what is Buddhism? What is Zen? What is training? What is practice? What is the mountains and rivers order? You know, we can think of that in terms of Zazen and liturgy and study, our 8-gauge training. We can think of it in terms of daily practice and Seshin and Ango, home practice. We can think of it in terms of practice during the time of COVID. We can look at the different arms of the Giteshvara, the Diamond Net, the Beyond Fear of Differences, the Earth Initiative, Prison Sangha, Zen Kids, the Monastery Store, our affiliates, all of these different hands and eyes, in the same way that we can think of ourself as fingers and elbows and knees and eyes. And but are any of those things you? Are any of these things what this is? Dogen said the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? We could say that all of this is just through pious, skillful means. But that begs the question, towards what end? Skillful means for what purpose? To be skillful means to be skillful towards some desired result. In the next verse that we're studying in the 37 verses of the practice of a bodhisattva, Tongmei Zampo says, like dew on the tip of a blade of grass, the pleasures of the three worlds last only a while, and then they vanish. Aspire to the never-changing supreme state of liberation. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. And I thought this was a good verse to have come to at this time when we're celebrating 40 years, which is a cause of celebration. You know, when I think about it, going back into the long history of Buddhism and the monasteries that have been in existence for hundreds and hundreds of years, you know, we're babies, infants, right? Just toddling, starting to find our strength, our wings, to begin to imagine the possibilities. But to a toddler, that's all they know, right? So if you're 6 months old, that's a lot. That's the whole of it. So 40 years is a lot. Like dew on the tip of a blade grass. Here, and then it's gone. What does that mean? How are all the many ways that we need to understand that? The Buddha said at the end of the Diamond Sutra, this is how you should think of all this fleeting world. A star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. Shantideva said it in another way. He said, the wanton lord of death, we can't predict. And life's tasks done or still to do, we cannot stay. And whether ill or well, we cannot trust our lives, our fleeting momentary lives. Everything I possess and use is like the fleeting vision of a dream. It fades into memory and fading is seen no more, never to come again. Never halting, night or day, my life is slipping by. And nothing that has passed can be regained. It will not come back again. And death is my only certainty. Thus, from this day forth, I go for refuge to the Buddhas, guardians of wandering beings, who labor for the good of all that lives, those mighty ones who scatter every fear. In the Dharma that resides within their hearts, that scatters all the terrors of samsara, and in the multitude of bodhisattvas, people, practitioners. Likewise, I will perfectly take refuge. Having taken refuge, now what do we do? In this practice of a bodhisattva. The earlier verses, it said, teachers have commented on this, have said that these earlier verses we've already studied are really speaking to the practitioner or the period in the practitioner's life, which is usually at the very beginning of training, where we really just want the suffering to stop. Just stop. We just want to stop hurting. We just want the pain to stop. And so those verses were directing us towards the sources of that suffering, the passion, the grasping that we feel towards friends and loved ones, the hatred we feel towards enemies, those places that disrupt us, that distract us, that create turmoil within us, that make it difficult to keep our eyes open, our heads straight. All those that we do love, everything that's precious in our life that we are going to lose because of impermanence, unhealthy friendships that bring out that which is not skillful in us. And so it's been directing us towards those things that we need to really become aware of, attentive to. But ultimately, and this verse is taking us, in a sense, into a new possibility, a new stage of practice. Ultimately, we need to be, and I hope want to be, free wherever we are, right? Because even a beginning practitioner should see the limitation, if we take these early verses literally, right? As though we are renouncing, cutting out of our lives, people, places, things. So what is that bubble? Where are you going to put yourself? Because where are you going to put yourself where you don't show up? Right? And so ultimately, we should want and need to be free and unhindered in all circumstances with all people. That's what our training is about. To aspire to the supreme state of liberation. And that's what this verse is directing us towards. The Dalai Lama said in his commentary, he said, think of it like an illness. You've got an illness and you take some aspirin, say. And it helps to relieve you of the symptoms of that illness. But if that illness has any deeper roots to it, it'll come back. Right? So that medicine is temporary. And he likened that to the practice of the precepts, of the paramitas, developing mindfulness, that these are all, in a sense, addressing the symptoms of what we're experiencing, the pain that we just want to take away, but not going to the root. And so he says, we have to go on and take other medicine to overcome the illness at its root. All the pleasures of the world, of the three worlds, last only a while, and then they vanish. But one of the things we should notice in this is that there's an acknowledgement, a recognition that there are pleasures of the world. And before they vanish, they're pleasurable. Right? And so there are many enjoyments in our lives. We've had a few of them this weekend. Right? Being together in the Dharma as practitioners, come together, drawn both by our own yearning and by finding that met in affinity within Dharma. And just the friendship, the community of being together in something that is meaningful, that is good in and of itself. Having food together. Doing good work. Feeling good feelings. Compassion, warmth, love, kinship. The accomplishments that we create and fulfill. Games that we play. Wait. Right? They do offer pleasure. Buddhism has acknowledged that from the very beginning. I mean, the Buddha was a pretty serious renunciant. I think of him as a pretty serious guy. Right? And yet it's interesting that every time somebody encountered him, particularly a lay person, the sutra always begins that they would acknowledge the Buddha and then they would chat. They don't say it that way. But the student wouldn't immediately sit down and sort of go for the goal. They would, you know, talk about the weather. Ask after each other's health. How are you? So there are these pleasures, these enjoyments that bring satisfaction, that bring fulfillment. They do. And they last for a while. That's the thing. To just know that, appreciate that. While they last, they're enjoyable, they're pleasurable. It's when we expect more from them. It's when they vanish and we don't expect that. Right? We were sure that this time they wouldn't. And when we really understand that it allows us to enjoy those pleasures and enjoyments and fulfillments and accomplishments, and see them not as unimportant, not as insignificant, when they are based in what is true and what is good, but when we don't want them to vanish, when we think they won't or that we can control them, we will look for more. We will want it to continue. And because they provide that pleasure and those enjoyments relatively easily, you know, you're hungry, you make a meal, and you make it so that it will be enjoyable. Right? You can do that. The wonder of food and spice. Right? It opens that door. And we do that, right? And we do that here, too. Right? We do that. We want the meal to be pleasurable, to be enjoyable. And those are easy things to do, easy, relatively easy things to obtain. And if we do that without clear understanding, that when the pleasure vanishes, we will want more, right? So having thrown a party, having had a good time, let's throw another one. Right? That was good. Let's do more. Kensei Rinpoche said, and commenting on this passage, that once we realize the futility of this cycle, right? The cycles of loving and hating and our attachments to that. The cycles of our obsessive habitual tendencies that come again and again and again, and that eventually we need to become tired of them. That those attachments that we can so easily fall into need to become tedious, wearisome. That all of our obsessive thinking about the past, about the future, we need to become weary of those things. That's an important part of practice, right? Because if we're not, that means there's still infatuation, there's still enchantment, right? They're still seductive. And yet even when we become weary of them, they still arise, right? We see that. We realize just actually sincerely wanting to break that cycle doesn't mean the cycle is broken. And that's the profound difference between an idea and a desire and an intention and practice. So what is the never-changing supreme state of liberation? Nirvana, that which is unborn, undying, uncreated. You can't create it. You can't create your liberation, no matter how smart you are. No suffering, no cause of suffering, no extinguishing, no path, no wisdom, no gain. And thus, the Bodhisattva lives Prajnaparamita. But why can't we just go there? Right? There's so many ways in which when we see something we want, we just set our sights on it and we go. We go directly. We do what we need to do to go there and to accomplish that. Why can't we do that? Or are we doing that? And we don't recognize the way that unfolds. The Dalai Lama said, first of all, we have to understand and identify our afflictive emotions as great troublemakers, right? Troublemakers. When Bodhi, in the poem in the Wumenkan, this is, after all, don't you know you are the troublemaker? It's these afflictive emotions that are the troublemakers. The Dalai Lama says, if we don't know the disadvantages of these afflictive emotions and continue to engage in them of our own accord, seek them out, then there's really no possible way we can free ourselves. Because it's those afflictive emotions which themselves are such a significant part of our bondage. These are also known as samskaras, Sanskrit term. And they're understood as formations, intentions. Sometimes they're spoken about it as intentions, our intentional actions. But afflictive emotions has always really struck me because the afflicted part, to be afflicted and to be able to resonate with that experience of being afflicted by something as when we're ill, right? We're afflicted with an illness, to be taken over, to have something as though something is occupying us. In the Tibetan, the word for samskaras means any state of being that causes one to be afflicted, to be unpeaceful, to be lacking in peacefulness, or to be uncomfortable. And everything that brings these into being, which is all of our karmic actions and our conditions of consciousness, our senses, our whole physiology, psycho mental being, and the world around us. The Buddha said all conditioned things, all samskaras, are impermanent and dukkha. They are our suffering. Not in and of themselves, but because of how we see them, relate to them, respond to them. They are the seeds, in the Yogacara teaching, the seeds of our store that reside within our storehouse consciousness, which is why how we explain how these afflictions, these afflictive emotions can appear, right? You didn't ask for this to appear. You didn't say, I'm going to get angry right now. I'm going to feel sad. I'm going to feel frightened. It just seems to appear. It's an essential element of the skandhas. It's in the 12-fold chain of causation. It's a fundamental aspect of the teaching. And it's in every one of these teachings, it's active. Right? Even when it's dormant, right? When it hasn't arisen, the seed being there means there's a kind of level of activity that is within us. And so that first, you know, aspect of practice that I spoke about a moment ago is we just, wanting the painkiller, we just want it to change. We just want it to stop, right? But when we are really begin to address the causes and the conditions, which is what practice is directly taking us to all the time, both examining them and actually bringing about a revolution, then we gain a measure of freedom in their cessation. But that cessation can still be not yet all the way to the root. And so when we actually go beyond the need for cessation, then that's liberation. The scholar Bill Waldron said, in sum, our individual samsaric existence is effectively little more than this mass of our accumulated karmic potential, our afflictive emotions and thoughts, the inertia of our latent dispositions, these deep, deep underlying tendencies that we all have, and our constructed behavioral and cognitive patterns, body and mind. We are little more than that, meaning the sense of self is little more than this sort of collection of collections. The Dalai Lama said, once an afflictive emotion is generated, the mind will not be quiet, will not return to stillness until that desired object is achieved. And so the normal way of achieving it is to satisfy the desire. Go where the desire is directing you to go. But in practice, what you do is you satisfy that desire by releasing it. Huainong said, don't bind your thoughts. He didn't say your thoughts are binding. Escape them. He said, don't bind your thoughts. They appear freely. Don't imprison them. Dalai Lama said, when we come under the influence of such emotions, there's very little possibility of being happy, truly happy. It's as though we're under the control of some awful master, a bad dictator. We need to see it clearly. I do on the tip of a blade of grass, the pleasures of the three worlds last only a while, and then they vanish. And so the three worlds, form, formlessness, and desire, and these can be looked at in different ways, but think of form, the realm of desire, rather, as the world that we all are born into, where desires are sort of the engine in the engine room, right? There's what kind of driving everything. What we want, what we don't want, fulfilling that. It's what occupies most of our waking day. And so because of that, we get hooked on the things, the objects of our desires. It makes sense. as well as all the proliferating ideas we have about all of those things. The realm of form is a more sort of evolved, developed realm. As a result of practice, where things are starting to become more loose, right? Not so solidified, not so tight, not so rigid. Things are starting to become themselves. You know, it's not a matter of deconstruction. Sometimes people speak of it. I don't see it that way, because it's not that. I mean, deconstruction is you have a solid building, now you have to take it apart nail by nail, brick by brick. The Buddha said, just take out the ridgepole, the whole thing will come down. Realize that the house itself is a proliferating concept. And so the realm of form coming out of a developing practice is a realm in which there's more stability, more mindfulness, more concentration, more understanding. And then finally, in the formless realm, that sense of solidity, of permanence, of self, has really begun to fall away. But each of these realms, even though they're more evolving and more free, are still considered samsara. You know, it's so interesting in the realms of existence teaching, you know, it's easy to understand the hell realm, the animal realm, you know, caught in dogma and instinct, hungry ghost realm. It's like, yeah, we can understand how those are not, not good places to hang out. But the God realm, I don't know. But in the angry God realm, right, which is abundant with lots of good stuff, but there's always somebody ahead of you, right? And you're not very happy about that, right? Because as long as there's somebody ahead of you, they got something you don't have. And that pisses you off. But when you're the one who's got it all, right, then you have pride because you got it all. Right, you're at the top of the heap. And so you get a little lazy, right? And it all starts to come apart. And so even these realms that we would seem to be, think of as the places we want to get to, the teachings make very clear, are only temporary. They too will vanish. They are not yet the never-changing supreme state of liberation. And so our practice, if it is to be true liberation, has to be deep and thoroughgoing. And the reason I think it's so good to bring this to our minds today is that as we look forward and we think about all the different things that we're engaged in, you know, at this time, in our world, in our nation, in our history, in the time of our earth, when the causes and conditions of our humanity, right, has become so dominant within this world of ours, the power of our reach, the reach of our intellect, our ability to create something, things that are so powerful that we only dimly understand, and very often it seems don't even care about what we don't understand about it. That doesn't matter to us. What we care about is what it gives us to now, right now. That's its validity. So at this time, when we're thinking about today and tomorrow, we are here to take up this bodhisattva practice, which is to realize the never-changing supreme state of liberation. When that stops, when that grows distant, then this has become something else. There may be good things happening. There almost certainly will be good things happening. There may be people coming together and practicing, there almost certainly will be. There will still be parties and celebrations. There will be all of the things that we're doing, but something will be gone. And in that way, it has begun to go, it has begun to vanish, has begun to vanish. An old master said, worldly people can cultivate stillness and silence, good feeling, community, all kinds of positive things through meditation, through practice. And this can temporarily pacify our obscurations. It can make us feel good, and it can bring forth good things. Good things. But they themselves will not give rise to insight. They will not fundamentally change. They will not go to the root. They will not help us to perceive our true nature. And so those obscurations will continue to arise. When our practice is merged with insight realization, is based in the aspiration, the dedication, the devotion to this never-changing supreme state of liberation, then all that we call Buddhism is present. And so as we sit here within our 40th year and in this weekend of imagining and dreaming, and so many wonderful things came out. That's the the magic, right, of coming together and speaking, right? Ideas just come proliferating in a good way, right? That we can do so much more together than we could ever do alone. We can think so much more broadly, so much more creatively, right? You just see it happening. It's like magic. It's like minds that begin in their own place, right? Within each person, and then they just start mingling, right? And something else happens, right? It's like a third thing. It's incredible. And it's necessary. It's important for us, right? In practice, there's so much emphasis on the moment. But that moment needs also to be within an awareness of the totality, right? And part of that totality is tomorrow, right? Which in this moment is in my mind. It can't exist anywhere else, right? It's an idea. So I imagine tomorrow. I imagine 5 years from now. I imagine where we might be, where I hope we be. We can imagine where we might be, where we hope we will be. We can do the same for the world. And we are doing lots of that. But we need that large arc of view. And so to study the way of mountains and rivers, to practice the true Dharma within this lineage of sanity and dignity. There was a period of time where Dharmaroshi used to speak a lot of our Sangha in this monastery in the temple as an archive of sanity. He was very happy with that phrase. I don't know if he just thought it up or found it somewhere, but every time he said it, you could see he really loved just saying it. Which is, I think of it as a lineage of, it's a lineage of Buddhism, Bodhisattvas, but it is a lineage of sanity, of trying to achieve our fundamental sanity, our sobriety. That is to liberate the bodies and minds of selves and others. It is to transmit the Buddha mind seal generation after generation. Maizumi Roshi, in the last poem he wrote just before his death, had a line where he says, do not let the wisdom seed of the Buddhas and ancestors be discontinued. Thus, I deeply implore you. I deeply implore you. You know, and it's a natural thing. When we're young, we only think about today. We get a little bit older, we start thinking about tomorrow. But as we get older, right, certainly in the mind of the Bodhisattva, in the mind of seven generations, we're thinking way beyond that. Right? We realize our life is just this life. It's important because we have possibilities, we have influence, but it's not the most important thing. The most important thing is the whole thing. My life is important because of your lives. It's important because of all the lives that will come. It's important because of all, whatever is possible in my life or in our lives is important because of all that is possible in the lives to come and that will be depending upon us. Causes and conditions. What we do is establishing the causes and conditions for everyone who will follow us, including the us that will follow in what we call tomorrow. So we are depending upon ourselves to establish those causes and conditions. So all of these years we've been gathering, and to in greater, lesser and greater degrees of understanding and awareness and consciousness and intention, we have been aligning our aspirations, renewing our commitments, being introduced, sometimes for the first time, with really, really important qualities like patience, perseverance, respect, generosity. We're introduced to or shown anew the power that we have, for instance, to think, to aspire, to speak, to commit, and more, I hope, we wake up each day in that, doing that. We wake up conscious to this day. This is the day you know you have. All the ones before, they're gone. All the ones to come, who knows? This is the one we have. And everything that will come depends on this day. I think of, you know, so many times I think of Dada Roshi's talking about how in the early years, when everything was just beginning to come together, right? There was so much that needed to be done. Oh, my Lord. Oof. And he would say to himself, we're just going to do this like it's happening. So he and his wife, Yushin, and his son, David, a couple others moved in, and they just started doing it like it's happening. And there were times in the early years where I also thought, is this thing real? Like, is this a real thing? Like, I know that Buddhism exists. I know that monasteries, is this one of those? Right? How would I know? And so in a way, even before I had heard those words, it was like, okay, I'm just going to do this like it's happening. I'm just going to do this like, yeah, this is it. This is what it is. And when I would think about it, I thought, well, but it must have, this must have happened 100 million times in the past. People just got together and just started doing it like it's happening. And it happened. I think of the ongoing stream of students, people, before they were even students, before there were students, who just started showing up, who came into residence and threw themselves into this. to train, to practice, to receive the teachings, and to give of themselves. Because that's what we do, right? We give and receive. This ongoing stream, you can just see this stream of people, if you think back all over the years, right? Because right now, here's a bunch of them. And right there, there's a bunch of them. And then those who became training students, and sort of the idea of that in Daito Roshi's mind, that the template at that time in Zen centers was to become members. And the Buddhists and the Doga... Daito Roshi said, no, not members. We are not members of the Dharma. We're students of the Dharma. We should be students. What does it mean to be a student? How do you enter as a student? What is that process? And so the development of the eight barrier gates. And so those who entered in, some of them have passed away. Some of them have just moved on to other paths. That's natural. Some of them are still here today. You are among them. Of the monastics, those who did take, have taken, will take full vows to live as clouds in water. Some have passed away. Some have moved on to other paths, which is natural. And some are still here. I think of Myotai Sensei, Daito Roshi's first successor, who was so important, so essential in our development here at the temple, in the city, before the temple, of Ryushin Sensei, and how important he was during the time that he was here. Of Hojin Sensei, Hogen Sensei, the teachers, all of the many beings who have come through and, in a sense, left their mark, right? Left their mark, left a piece of themselves, of their heart, of their intention, of their hands, their work, their efforts. You know, so when I look back, I think we're so fortunate. We've had so many fortunate circumstances and conditions. I remember many years ago going to another Dharma center, a Tibetan Buddhist Dharma center, and just, they seemed to be doing so well, right? And I came back and was just sort of like, oh God, I wish, you know. And I said, no, we're doing fine. He believed so strongly in how important it was that however we made our way, it needed to be in the Dharma. What we do needed to be how we made it possible for us to be here. Specifically, that we could not survive on fundraising. We needed to work for our daily bread. He really believed in that. And then we could do fundraising for so many important things, like the Jizo House. But there was something important about that we put our actual bodies and efforts on the line to give, and in that way we will receive, and we will then make this happen. And so we've had so many fortunate circumstances and conditions, just this building. This mountain. I mean, think about it. How much of your experience of this place, particularly those of you who've been here, is sort of mixed all up with this building, right? With this mountain, with the air flowing in the windows, the light, right? Because that's what we're made of. That's what makes us, is all of that. And so we have really had so much abundance, and we have faced some great challenges. We have had some great trials. Starting at the beginning, And then along the way, and we will have more. I'm just telling you. I don't know what they are yet, but they're coming. And we will meet them. And every challenge we make teaches us how to do that. It teaches us how to be bodhisattvas. It teaches us how to practice now. Who can imagine our world in 5 or 10 or 15 years? Somebody asked Dada Roshi that at the 10th year. And he said, really, in my mind, it's unimaginable. He says, it's futile to even try to think about what it's going to be. And that was for real. You know, there were lots of times we tried to pin him down and he just would not have it. He said, I don't know. He said, what I am sure of is what's happening right now and what I need to do right now. He was speaking for himself. He says, if I take care of things now properly, as long as I'm in this role as abbot, I will have provided the fundamental stuff that future generations can build on. If I get too far ahead of myself or try to plan for other people, I'm just going to put them into a box, a kind of straitjacket, and create a situation where they're not free to adapt to circumstances. I'm sure the Buddha could have never imagined Buddhism in the 20th century with the questions and the problems and the circumstances of today. If he had tried to define it too tightly, we wouldn't have now the flexibility within the Dharma, within training, to be able to do what we need to do. This is why it's so vital that it is a transmission outside sutras. It is a mind-to-mind, direct, intimate, person-to-person. It must be this way. That is the only way to realize the supreme, unchanging, fundamental truth. And so that, you know, when we talk about our mission, that fundamentally is our mission. When that is clear, then everything else flows from that. That's the point of having a clear mission. That everything else flows out of that. And when you get confused or you're not sure or something else comes up that seems super essential, super urgent, and may be, how does it feed into that single stream that is the lifeblood? That without that, the whole begins to turn into something else. And that something else can take a long time to realize that something has been lost. Because you're just living it every day, right? And good things are still happening. And so that's part of our work, right? And particularly for the teachers, and, you know, it's part of what this weekend is about, is to remember that. Right? That's what bodhicitta is. Because the fact of the matter is, even though it's the single most important thing and it is the ocean from which every stream emerges, it's also the most difficult thing. In a way, it is the easiest thing to lose because all of that other stuff, just like our sensual pleasures, are so easy to obtain. And so there has to be a kind of trusting wakefulness, right? And returning to these teachings, returning to our vows, returning to that fundamental question of why am I doing this? Why are we doing this? I spoke yesterday in the memorial of Dada Roshi as a fisherman, throwing out his line and bait into deep waters, waiting for high-spirited dragons to bite. Right? So, dude, we just sit here and wait. Every time somebody walks in the door, bite. Right? Maybe they're just nibbling. Right? But they have come into contact with the hook. And I said, though you have laid down your reel Dragons continue to emerge from muddy waters, seeking satisfaction for the sake of today. And so we bow to you, Tadada Roshi. We bow to all the Buddhas and ancestors. We bow to each other, because we are depending on each other for all of the many gifts. The Tadada Roshi, that all of the teachers going back, that we give to each other and recognize they continue to flow. Oh, yes. They continue to flow. And so may they indeed flow. I so hope that in 100, 200, 500 years, somebody, there are butts sitting on these cushions. The same cushions. Right? We use things until they're completely worn out. Same cushions in this Zendo on a day like this, a beautiful autumn day, engaging the Dharma. That's a gift worth giving. That's a life worth living to offer ourselves up for. May it be so.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.